Macmillan Audio presents One Last Lie by Paul Dworin. Read for you by Henry Leva. The world is full of obvious things which nobody by any chance ever observes. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, The Hound of the Baskervilles. Chapter 1. Before I left for Florida, my old friend and mentor, Charlie Stevens, gave me a puzzling piece of advice. Never trust a man without secrets. I thought he'd misspoken. Don't you mean a man with secrets? But the retired game warden only winked, as if to suggest he'd said exactly what he'd intended to say. It would be up to me to figure out the meaning of his cryptic remark. I went to Miami to do a background check on an Air Force vet who had applied for a job with the Maine Warden Service and about whose character I had vague yet creeping doubts. On paper and in a series of face-to-face interviews, Tom Wheelwright had appeared to be the ideal candidate to become our next chief pilot. A Maine native currently residing in Key Biscayne, he was a decorated combat veteran with more than enough air hours to qualify him for the position. He was quick on his toes, clear-eyed, and a family man, with a presentable wife and three presentable children. When I'd asked him why he wanted to trade the salary of a Learjet pilot for that of a Maine state employee, he said he hoped to raise his kids somewhere that still felt like a real place. It was a good answer. Still, I couldn't shake the feeling that Wheelwright was not the paragon everyone swore he was. For the past week, I had been interrogating every aspect of the man's life. I had started with the list of references he had provided. I spoke with his wife and parents, his brothers and sisters, his commanding officers in the Air Force, the management of the charter airline that employed him, former co-workers, neighbors, friends. I had reviewed multiple credit reports, paused over a criminal history that consisted of nothing but frequent speeding tickets, and found no red flags. Everything checked out, except for the familiar voice inside my head. Never trust a man without secrets. It was Charlie's dictum that had prompted me to keep digging until I unearthed a name conspicuous by its absence from any of the files I'd been given. Captain Joe Fixico now worked part-time running airboat tours out of Shark Valley in the Everglades. But during the first Gulf War, he had flown multiple sorties over Iraq as Wheelwright's electronic warfare officer. Captain Fixico had, coincidentally, also retired from the Air Force to South Florida. The two flyboys lived less than 30 miles from each other, and yet Wheelwright hadn't included on his disclosure list the one man who could best speak to his coolness at the stick and his courage under fire. Fixico himself seemed surprised when I finally reached him by phone.
Tommy listed me as a reference?
As a matter of fact, he didn't.
Well, that's understandable, I guess. We're not as close as we were during the war.
He had a rough, rasping voice that made me imagine he possessed a fondness for tobacco.
I'm sorry, what did you say your name was again?
Mike Bowditch. Would you be able to get together tomorrow, Captain?
Of course,
he'd said.
And please, call me Joe.
Then my new friend had invited me to his house in the outermost ring of the Miami suburbs. The next morning, however, Fixico called back twice. The first time to push our appointment to late afternoon, the second time to change the location to a restaurant owned by the Miccosukee tribe of Native Americans out in the Glades.
You can't miss it,
he said in a voice that sounded even scratchier than it had the night before.
It's across the highway from the National Park entrance. Look for the sign advertising fried gator tail and all-you-can-eat frog's legs.
When I'd laughed at what I'd assumed to be hyperbole, the line went quiet.
Do you think I'm proud of it? He'd finally said. That I don't know it's a caricature? Just be glad I'm willing to meet with you at all, Warden Bowditch.
I hadn't realized until that moment that Joe Fixico was himself a Miccosukee. Nor did I understand why the formerly cooperative Air Force captain was now playing hard to get. The temperature was 88 degrees. The relative humidity was 90%. The swollen canal behind my airport motel smelled rank and diseased, like a mouthful of rotten teeth. I was overdressed in a navy linen suit, a sky blue cotton shirt, suede chukka boots, and a SIG P-239 handgun holstered on my belt. I also carried a badge identifying me as a Maine game warden investigator. When traveling on duty out of state, I was required to present myself as a law enforcement officer. People assumed I was a plainclothes police detective, which in a sense I was, the difference being that most of the crimes I investigated back home were perpetrated against wildlife. Not having anything else to do with my unanticipated free time, I decided to play tourist. I had never visited Florida. In 31 years on Earth, I had rarely even left the state of Maine. I was parochial enough, for instance, to think the name of the four-lane highway that carried me across the flooded sawgrass prairie had an Aboriginal music to it, the Tamiami Trail. Later, I learned it was just a mashup of the highway's starting and ending points, Tampa and Miami. The contraction was cooked up by a cynical developer to entice emigres from Middle America to buy bulldozed swampland. Florida had been built on a foundation of fraud and false promises as much as on a bedrock of limestone, riddled with holes and prone to devastating collapses. In the lot outside the Shark Valley Visitor Center, I spotted dozens of cars and RVs, and I wondered, what kind of fool chooses to go wildlife watching in the heat of a late June day when every breath feels like being waterboarded? Then I caught sight of my sweating reflection in the glass booth where I paid my admission, and I knew what kind of fool. The birds, though. Great and snowy egrets, blue and tricolored herons, and anhingas posed cruciform in the mangroves, drying their wings, glossy and white ibises, roseate spoonbills and purple gallinules walking across water lilies with their grotesquely oversized feet. Alligators lolled ridge-backed in the canals or sprawled in the verges between the paved walk and the stream. Enormous catfish, gar and tilapia, floated with a flutter of fins beneath the tea-colored surface. Never had I encountered nature in such glorious, riotous abundance. An eye-popping, caterwauling carnival of life. I had probably lost 10 pounds in water weight when, remembering my appointment, I returned to my rented sedan, buckled on my sidearm, pulled on my suit jacket, and drove across the street to the restaurant that served deep-fried reptiles. When I stepped through the door, a blast of air conditioning hit me in the face with the force of a meat freezer thrown open. "I'm supposed to meet someone?" I told the host. His skin was the color of bronze, and he wore his black hair long and parted straight down the center.
"He's not here yet."
"I'll sit down."
"I think you'd better."
The interior was festively decorated in bright colors and Native American motifs. The only customers were two white families, clearly foreign, clearly tourists, and a black man with gray hair seated at the lunch counter reading a fishing magazine. My waitress was so concerned that I might collapse of dehydration that she left a filled water pitcher on the table. She brought another 5 minutes later when I'd drained the first. Half an hour passed. The families ate and left and were replaced by more families and an elderly couple and some college-age boys who were loud even before they ordered Budweisers all around. The man at the counter had managed to disappear without my seeing him leave. My server asked if I wanted to order some food while I could.
"We'll be closing soon. We close at 4 o'clock.
"Why so early?"
"We close when the park closes."
I tried Fixico's phone number, but got an automated reply. I left a curt message for him to call me. As the restaurant emptied, I could feel the host watching me. willing me to get up and leave the way a cat wills you to feed it. I put down a $10 bill for the water and the trouble. Chapter 2. I sat in my rented Hyundai with the air conditioning cranked and fog inching up the windshield, trying to decide how to proceed. If I left now, I might still catch my flight home. But the hook had been set, and I wasn't breaking free without a fight. Why had Fixico brought me all the way out into the Everglades only to stand me up? Why not just tell me over the phone that upon further reflection, he had nothing to say about Captain Tom Wheelwright? Because he wanted to have a look at me first. In the rearview mirror, I noticed the man who'd seated me leaving the restaurant. He paused to tuck his white polo into his pants and put on a pair of wraparound shades before making his way toward a Chevrolet Camaro parked in the thin shade of a palm. Careful of fire ants, I crossed the sandy lot. "Excuse me, sir." The bronze man lurched to a stop. "You're still here?" "I have a question for you."
"Okay."
"When I told you I was meeting someone, you said, 'He's not here yet.' How did you know I was meeting a man?"
"You said you were."
"No, I didn't."
"I think you're confused. Look, I've got to pick up my kid."
I watched the sports car accelerate onto the cracked highway headed back toward Miami. Then I shaded my eyes with the blade of my hand and scanned the endless flatness. I hadn't seen the man at the counter leave, but I saw him now, not 100 yards away. Beyond the restaurant stood a second, smaller building with the same thatched roof, a tribal information center, and beyond that was a dirt lot that bordered a dull canal that might or might not have been the Shark River. The black man I'd noticed inside the restaurant stood on the bank, wearing a Panama hat, smoking a cigar, and fishing with a cane pole unlike anything I'd ever seen in Maine. "Captain Fixico?" His back stiffened, but he spoke without turning.
"I was beginning to have doubts about you as an investigator, Warden Bowditch. You didn't expect me to be black. Some of us natives are.
Do you want to tell me what that stunt was about?" He tossed the cigar butt into the greenish water. A small fish came up to snap at it. A bigger fish rose from the depths to swallow the smaller fish whole. There's always someone bigger, someone hungrier. When Fixico finally faced me, I saw that he had an indentation in his forehead that spoke of a head injury neither recent nor ancient. His nose was straight, his brow slanting, and his eyes were so heavily lidded he seemed half asleep.
"I wanted to check you out before we talked," he said,
a little smile playing in the corners of his mouth. "And you didn't like my looks?"
"Not particularly." "How did you find me?"
"It took a while."
"That's not what I meant. How did you find me in the first place? You said Tommy didn't give you my name as a character witness."
Witness? I made a mental note of the word choice. "Maybe I'm a better investigator than I look." He laughed at that and gestured toward an SUV that gleamed white across the lot.
"Let me get this line in and we can talk inside my Rogue so you don't melt any more than you already have, Mr. Snowman. I'll tell you the truth about the great Tom Wheelwright. The whole truth and nothing but."
The interior of the SUV smelled of his Cubanos. I observed a cigar burn in the otherwise pristine leather upholstery. He removed his straw hat and set it on the dash. Unlike Wheelwright, who was impossibly fit in middle age, Fixico had acquired a belly since his Air Force days. He wore a Guayabera shirt, relaxed-fit jeans, and flip-flops. A medical alert bracelet hung like a bangle from one thin wrist.
"So you're a detective?" he said. "And your bureau flew you all the way down here to run a background check on a man applying to become a game warden? I never would have thought that was an actual thing."
"In fact, investigating applicants to the Maine Warden Service was one of my most important duties," Many people participated in the hiring process, including a psychologist and a polygraph operator, but ultimately it was my responsibility to prevent an unfit candidate from acquiring a badge and gun. "Do you mind if I record this?" Pixico reached for an aluminum tube on the center console, unscrewed the end, and shook out a cigar.
"I'd prefer we talk on deep background, if you don't mind."
"Are you concerned about retribution from the Air Force?" He had a laugh that seemed to scrape his vocal cords.
"What are they gonna do to me that's worse than what God dished out? You wouldn't think it to look at me, but I graduated magna cum laude from Dartmouth. I used to be brilliant. The undamaged part of my brain still is. It's new memories I can't retain."
What interested me was the old stuff. "So, you and Wheelwright flew EF-111A Ravens in the war?"
"Sparkvarks, that's what we called them. Technically, Tom did the flying, and my job was to fuck with Saddam's communications, an activity at which I excelled. After I came back from the Gulf, I thought I was headed for a career at a defense contracting firm. Six-figure income, big house outside the Beltway, marry a white woman. The Native American dream."
He smiled ironically through a cloud of cigar smoke.
"None of that has anything to do with Tom Wheelwright. He wasn't in Las Vegas when my Corvette was T-boned or when I woke from my coma to learn I was being medically retired. Why did Tommy tell you he chose to leave the Air Force?"
"He said he couldn't resist the money he was promised to fly Lear jets for the 1%.
"That's partially true, I suppose. Tom's always been good at using truthful statements to mislead. Or maybe he's one of those people who passes polygraphs because they believe their own bullshit.
I have all his military records, including his honorable discharge. There's not a blemish in his file."
"There wouldn't be. Pilots are held to different standards, especially when it comes to reports of inappropriate conduct with the other sex."
"Why is there no mention of harassment charges?"
"It's the Air Force. Where have you been living for the past 15 years? Tom was encouraged to take early retirement."
Pixico rolled down his window to relieve the fog.
"Now you're thinking, why should I take the word of a brain-damaged engine over the United States Air Force? Because I can give you names is why. I can point you to the women. But I have a feeling you already believe me."
He was right on that account. I tried to lean forward, but my shirt adhered to the upholstery as if with paste. "Last night you said you were willing to talk about Tom Wheelwright. Today you gave me the slip. What made you change your mind, Captain?"
"Truth be told, I don't recall our conversation all that well. As I said, I have a problem forming new memories. But back when Tommy and I were hot shots in the USAF, before my brain injury, I was as cocky as he was. It was the crash that humbled me. Do you know how often I overhear kids asking their moms about the man with the dent in his head? When the world looks at you and sees a freak, you no longer have the luxury of ignoring the truth." He absently stroked the moon crater in his forehead. "But I still haven't answered your question. What made me change my tune? I realized the significance of Tommy not giving you my name. He was afraid I'd acquired a conscience as a result of my misfortunes, and rightly so. People have been covering for that man his whole life, me included. I decided the time had come for someone to knock the great Wheelwright off his pedestal." Alone again in my car, I called the first woman whose name Fixico had given me, a former Air Force second lieutenant now living outside Omaha, Nebraska.
"How did you find me?"
she'd asked with a flutter of panic. And with that, my job was done.
Chapter 3. My flight left without me. I may even have watched the plane take off from the freeway where I was stalled in traffic. The cause of the holdup was a fatality, the second I'd witnessed on the Florida highways. The dead man lay in the median grass with the blanket over him. His wrecked car looked like it had gone through a junkyard compactor. In addition to the usual first responders, I spotted half a dozen white and green Border Patrol vehicles. Unable to do anything except crawl forward, I put in a call to the officer supervising the search for a new chief warden pilot. Major Patrick Shorey had been on the panel that had hired me 8 years earlier. His had been a dissenting voice. So, of course, he was an unabashed champion of Tom Wheelwright.
"You said this Seminole you interviewed suffered a brain injury?"
"Captain Fixico is a Miccosukee, not Seminole."
"The point is he has memory problems."
"But the two women I spoke with don't, and they were both open about the extent of Wheelwright's sexual misconduct. Assaults is the better word."
"Why didn't they file complaints against him with the Air Force?"
"They say they were dissuaded from doing so by their superiors."
"Two dozen people vouch that Captain Wheelwright conducted himself with bravery and professionalism. Why should we take the word of these women?"
"Because they didn't know about each other. They never served together. There's no way they could have coordinated their stories."
"It's a fine world we're living in when a war hero can have his reputation destroyed by undocumented allegations."
"Captain Fixico gave me more names if you'd like."
"Just send me the damn report."
The traffic began to inch ahead, then stopped again. I checked my messages and found a text from the kid I'd hired to watch my dog. Logan Kronk was the son of friends who lived down the road from me on the Maine mid-coast. The boy was 10, blonde, and big for his age. Or any age.
"Shadow ate a turkey poult. It landed inside his pen while he was sleeping under the trees, and it didn't see him, and he leaped out from the bushes and ate it in like 3 bites.
Legally speaking, Shadow wasn't a dog. He was a wolf dog. To be even more precise, he was a gray wolf with a smattering of domestic dog genes. His pen was a fenced enclosure on my wooded property, roughly 1.5 acres in area. Logan had attached several photographs so that I could rest assured he had been fulfilling his duties. One picture was of himself holding a turkey wing pinion, presumably all that was left of Shadow's lunch. I wrote the boy back thanking him and adding that he'd better not have ventured inside the fence to retrieve those feathers. The wolf dog may have been raised in captivity, but he had spent the past few years on the run in the Maine mountains, killing deer and digging beavers out of their lodges. And I didn't trust him not to eat children. I considered the empty hours ahead. My ex-girlfriend, Stacy Stevens, the woman I had once considered the love of my life, and who was not insignificantly the daughter of my mentor, Charlie, and his wife, Aura, lived less than 2 hours away. Stacy's last communication months before had been an email that ended with the words, "If by some small miracle you're ever in Florida, I would love, love, love to see you." Before I could slip down this dangerous slope, I called my current girlfriend back home. "I'm afraid I'm here for one more night," I told Danielle Danny Tate. "I hope the last interview was worth it." "Let's just say that Tom Wheelwright will never be a member of the Maine Warden Service." Danny was younger than I was, a former game warden who had transferred to the Maine State Police because she saw greater opportunities for advancement. To the world, she presented one face, snub-nosed, gruff, blonde hair tied up tight, a badass cop. To me, and me alone, she showed a gentler profile. Soft gray eyes, dimples that only made themselves known when she smiled, a heart that was twice the size of mine. As the sky darkened at the edges, leaving a hazy dome of light above the city, I told Danny about Fixico. She listened quietly as I recounted the day's revelations,
Proud of myself, I ended the monologue with two of the women Wheelwright had coerced into having sex with him.
Congratulations, Danny said.
I detected an undercurrent of sarcasm.
Thanks?
No, it's great that you nailed Wheelwright, but the odds are good that the guy you end up hiring will be a sleaze too. He'll just be better at covering his tracks.
She let that sit with me for a moment. Then her tone lightened again.
So, what are you going to do with your free night in Miami? Go clubbing in South Beach?
The last footprints I left on a dance floor were in junior high.
That's probably for the best.
The joke was at her expense as well as mine. Trooper Tate was not remotely footloose.
What? I laughed. You don't think I can dance?
You won't like my answer to that question. I paused before I spoke again.
I promised Stacy I would be in touch if I ever got down this way.
Danny didn't skip a beat.
Doesn't she live over on the Gulf Coast?
Everglades City. That's about 2 hours from here, I think. Chances are she'll be busy anyway, but I will have made an effort.
And her folks will be happy, which matters to me, as you know. I'll probably end up back at my motel with a pizza watching baseball.
You're presuming I'm jealous.
You're not?
I'm not in sixth grade, Mike. You two shared a lot together. It's sad if you can't be friends. I trust you, and I hope you trust me. Give Stacy my best if you see her.
The truth is, I could use a good night's rest.
Me too.
I think I caught a bug.
My favorite photo of Stacy stared up from the lighted screen of my phone. I had taken the picture on a summer evening 4 years earlier while we were canoeing the famed Allegash Wilderness Waterway in northern Maine. Her dark hair was tousled. There was a sheen of perspiration on her cheekbones. Her eyes were the color of jade. Stacy and I had lived together for close to 2 years, and everyone assumed we would get married. She was the daughter of people I already loved like parents. We shared a passion for the outdoors. She was intelligent, fearless, and capable. For a long time, I had believed she must be my soulmate. In the end, it was the qualities we had in common that drove us apart. Where I was reckless, she was almost pathologically irresponsible. Where I was stubborn, she was unyielding to a fault. Where I was quick to anger, she stoked her rage with a red-hot poker. Our decision to separate had been no less sad for being by mutual agreement. Stacy answered at once.
Well, howdy, stranger.
How did you know it was me?
I have you in my list of favorites. I'm looking at your picture right now. You're in your field uniform, looking all brooding and handsome.
I don't look like that anymore. I grew my hair out for my job as an investigator.
Just as long as it isn't a mullet.
So listen, I'd love to catch up, but you caught me as I was walking out the door.
Was it relief I felt or disappointment?
I'll let you go then.
Not without telling me why you called.
What's up?
I'm in Florida.
No shit. Where?
West of Miami. I'm stuck in traffic on the 836. I just saw an exit for Sweetwater.
You have to come see me. You'll regret it for the rest of your life if you pass this up.
Pass what up? I asked, worried.
We're going on a wild python hunt.
Chapter 4. On the flight to Miami, I had passed the hours reading a natural history guide to South Florida. The book included a section devoted to imported reptiles, notably Burmese pythons and Nile monitor lizards, that had either escaped captivity or been released by negligent pet owners. Without natural predators, these two invasive species had taken over the wet prairies, pine hammocks, and cypress swamps south of Lake Okeechobee. Biologists had found deer fawns, raccoons, wild piglets, marsh rabbits, and even alligators inside the bellies of the pythons. Out of desperation, the state was holding derbies with cash prizes for civilian hunters who killed the most and biggest snakes. That afternoon, a hiker had reported an enormous Burmese python near a trailhead in the Big Cypress National Preserve. Stacy was joining a biologist friend in an attempt to locate and capture the monster snake before it swallowed someone's toddler. She told me to meet her at a place called 40 Mile Bend, 10 minutes west of the Miccosukee restaurant.
"It'll be like old times," she promised.
That was what worried me. We had brought out the worst in each other more often than the best. By ourselves, we were daredevils. Together, we were a pair of lunatics. But how could I resist the adventure of hunting a serpent that reached lengths of 20 feet and could weigh as much as 200 pounds? The sun was setting, but I couldn't see it for the black clouds boiling out of the gulf. As I neared Shark Valley, I saw the first blue pulses of electricity lighting up the thunderheads from within. The wind blew palm fronds and palmetto fans onto the slick blacktop. By the time the sign for 40 Mile Bend appeared in my headlights, the rain was pelting my windshield like birdshot. A Land Rover with a canoe strapped to the roof rack flicked its headlights as I turned into a circular drive outside the Tamiami Ranger Station. I pulled on my raincoat and hurried across the surface of crushed white shells that seemed to be what road builders used here in lieu of gravel. The wet air smelled of swamp plants my northern nose couldn't identify. Inside the Rover, she pulled me close enough that the fumes from the bug dope on her skin knocked me out. She looked leaner, with the beginnings of wrinkles around her almond-shaped eyes. She placed a tanned hand on either side of my face.
"You're all grown up."
"I like to think I was before." "Do you have a head net and bug suit?" "I am an investigator. I was here doing background checks." She always became most beautiful when she laughed.
"You really have no idea what you're in for tonight. Florida mosquitoes are relentless. They make the Terminator look weak-willed.
They can't be any worse than the black flies back home."
"That's like saying death by hanging can't be any worse than death by firing squad."
She handed me a small bottle of mosquito repellent. "You should buckle up. The drive to Gator Hook Strand is going to be wet and wild." She put the transmission into gear and skidded onto the black road that split off the four-lane, heading southwest into what looked like real backcountry.
"I can't believe you're really here," she said, smiling again. "Stranger in a strange land."
"You seem to have adapted."
"I wouldn't be so sure. Did my mom and dad make you promise to come see me when they heard you were visiting Florida?"
"Not in so many words." Charlie and Aura Stevens had been heartbroken when Stacy and I split up. Aura had intuited that things hadn't been great for a while, but Charlie had nurtured dreams of grandchildren.
"Being so far from my folks is the hardest part of living here," she said.
"I keep inviting them down, but you know how my mom feels about planes." Aura Stevens had been paralyzed below the waist in a plane crash during a flying lesson from her husband. He'd walked away from the wreckage with nothing but a broken arm and a crushing weight on his conscience.
"Of course, my dad knows South Florida like the back of his hand from the months he spent here back in the aughts."
"What?"
"The state of Florida hired him to help with an aerial survey counting manatees."
"He never told me that." She twitched her nose bewitchingly.
"Charlie Stevens, international man of mystery."
I slathered bug dope behind my ears. It smelled like the liquid poison it was.
"How's your job going?"
"Besides soul crushing, we had 40 Florida panthers killed in the state last year. Up from the year before. We build fences along the highways and wildlife underpasses they can use to cross from one side to the other, but that doesn't help along all the back roads where people speed along at night at 80 miles an hour. Meanwhile, development keeps encroaching into their habitat because what's the value of an endangered species compared to selling the next Del Boca Vista? And now we're seeing a crippling disorder in some of the cats that inhibits coordination of their rear legs. Wasn't there a crazy king who tried to fight the rising tide with a sword?"
"That's me."
"Since when does your work involve catching pythons?"
It doesn't. But once a biologist, always a biologist. My friend Buster is in charge of python eradication for the National Park Service, and God knows he needs the help. From what I read, it sounds like the snakes are here to stay. That depends on your frame of reference. What do you mean? In 50 years, South Florida will be underwater, and the pythons will be Georgia's problem. So, you said the Warden Service is looking for a new chief warden pilot? Maybe I should apply. Ha ha. Who says I'm joking? I must have shown alarm. You should see the look on your face, she said. Don't worry. I'm just having fun with you. At the edge of the high beams, I saw a mud-spattered Ford Expedition with what I assumed was a snake-spotting tower bolted onto the SUV's roof. A wide-beamed man in jeans and hip waders leaned over the tailgate, rummaging around for something. He straightened up when he heard our engine. He had long gray hair beneath a camouflage-patterned fedora, a stubble beard, and skin the color of a baked ham. "That's Buster Lee. If anyone can find this snake, it's him." She opened her door and leaned out. "I brought along a helper." The man's drawl was so slow and syrupy it had to be a put-on.
"The swamp's no place for amateurs, Stevens."
"This is Mike Bowditch, my game warden friend from Maine. You remember me telling you about him?" He was wearing a safari shirt stretched tight across his belly. In one hand, he held a floppy canvas bag, in the other, a 5-foot-long hooked tool, presumably a snake-catching device.
"He doesn't look like any conservation officer I ever met."
Stacy shook her head at me in mock disbelief. I couldn't remember seeing her in such high spirits. Despite the bug dope, the mosquitoes had already begun to mob the bare skin of my face and the fleshy parts of my exposed hands. Finally, Buster let the deadpan drop.
"Hell, son, I'm just having fun with you. Any friend of Stevens is a friend of mine. So you're the warden she's always going on about.
Stacy tells me you're Florida's champion python catcher." He struck a heroic pose with the hook tool and the gunny sack.
"I don't call myself that, understand. It's an honorific others have bestowed upon me, but I'm not going to say I don't deserve the title. Is this your first python hunt, Warden Mike?"
"They haven't made it to Maine yet, fortunately, except as pets."
"That's how they arrived here, too."
He fastened a headlamp over his brimmed fedora and fiddled with it to get the beam properly aligned.
"Florida is the world capital of unintended consequences."
The raindrops slapped the flat leaves of the palmettos. Lightning flashed to the south, but the thunder took a long time rolling across the sawgrass prairie. At least we would be safe from electrocution.
"How do you plan on finding a snake in the dark?" I asked.
Buster let his drawl drop.
"The man who reported it said it was in blue."
"That means its eyes were opaque," explained Stacy. "It's getting ready to shed its skin."
"Shedding snakes go inactive," Buster explained. "The little ones hide because they're vulnerable, but these big boys and girls don't have natural enemies. They're the new apex predators in town, so they just camp out wherever, go into temporary brumation."
"That's like hibernation," Stacy translated.
"Enough talking," said the python catcher, recovering his false drawl. "More walking."
We began our hike single file across a board bridge and down the wet path, illuminating both sides with our headlamps. Lush green ferns sprouted everywhere except in spots where pale limestone outcroppings poke through the humus. The trees along the trail were too scraggly to keep off the face-smacking rain. I recognized a few species from my nature guide: live oak, poisonwood, gumbo limbo. All the trunks were crawling with big banded snails like mobile carbuncles. The mud sucked with real determination at my shoes, eager to steal them from my feet. The onslaught of mosquitoes continued unabated. I wondered which disease I was most likely to contract: malaria, dengue fever, or the Zika virus.
Don't let Buster fool you, Stacy said in a whisper. He's not even from the South. He got a Ph.D. in herpetology from the University of Wisconsin. He just gets a kick out of playing the cracker.
Kind of like your father, except he's a different brand of cracker.
Touché.
Off in the darkness, not 100 feet away, something screamed. Not called, not shrieked, but screamed. My first morbid thought was of a young girl being stabbed to death. Stacy didn't slow or stop. From around the next bend, Buster called to us,
"Hey, lovebirds!"
We hurried in the direction of his voice and found the herpetologist huffing wind beside a bench. He had his headlamp focused on the ground at his boots, but as we approached, he raised the beam just enough to show a pale, coiled form in the slough. If the python hadn't been shedding its skin, I never would have spotted it. Stacy let out a whistle.
She's huge! How do you know it's a she?
I asked in a whisper.
The females are usually bigger than the males.
Here's a fun fact for you, Warden Mike,
Buster Lee said, taking a tentative step down the bank.
Female pythons can produce offspring without even mating. I'm not shitting you. Look it up. The process is called facultative parthenogenesis. Lots of human females would sign up for that deal, I would wager.
Do you want me to go down there with you?
Stacy asked, speaking fast in her eagerness. It's easier for one person to grab the head, he said. Just be ready to pounce on her coils before she can wrap them around my neck. I had never been content being a bystander.
What can I do?
Spectate.
I watched as Buster slid down the muddy embankment into the edge of the water, maybe 2 yards behind the snake's pale head. The ghostly creature seemed not to register the man's approach at all. I was beginning to think he moved with a certain unexpected grace for a person of his girth. Then, he took a step forward, lost his footing, and fell face first into the brown water. The splash caused the snake to awaken, and faster than seemed possible, it ducked into the undergrowth. Buster sprang up from the drink to grab desperately at the tail. His fedora and headlamp had disappeared. Despite how wet he was, he managed to get a grip. The python, brought up short, whipped around with its pale mouth wide and bit him on the face. Buster gave a whimper, stumbled, and half disappeared beneath the surface, which the snake was now churning to a coffee froth. I knew constrictors did this, used their backward curving teeth to secure a hold on prey, or also presumably an attacker, but I hadn't expected this one to act like a monster out of a horror movie, and neither did the two biologists.
Buster!
Stacy jumped down to help. The python's distended jaws had fastened on his nose and chin. Gushing blood showed red in my flashlight beam. The coils wrapped around Buster's arm, chest, and throat were as thick around as my thigh. Stacy tried to pull the snake free, but her efforts only seemed to cause the serpent to latch on to Buster all the harder. I considered shooting it, but there was no way to fire a round through the head that didn't risk hitting the man. What I would have given for a canister of pepper spray. Then I remembered. I reached into my pocket and found the small bottle. I leaped clear off the bank and went into the water up to my chest. Blood pumped rhythmically through Buster Lee's fingers as he gripped the triangular skull. The fight had torn tatters in the python's bluish hide. It looked like a zombie serpent. As Buster muttered and moaned, I directed my pump dispenser of bug repellent at the snake's squeezed shut eyes. The poisonous liquid just ran off harmlessly. Then I caught a flash of pinkish white, the corner of the python's mouth. I sprayed the exposed tissue with a shot of 100% diethyl toluamide, commonly known as DEET. And just like that, Buster was free. To his credit, the herpetologist continued to fight the thrashing, half-poisoned animal. He closed a hand around the throat below its jaws. Between the two of them, they wrestled the enormous serpent up the bank.
"Get the bag!" Stacy said.
I used the overhanging vines to pull myself out of the sloshing water.
Then, on hands and knees, I crawled across the soaked grass to grab the burlap sack. I couldn't imagine how 100 pounds of serpentine muscle could fit inside it. Somehow, they managed the feet. Half-blind with blood, Buster knotted the top so the snake couldn't escape. The sack pulsed like the gullet of a water bird that had just swallowed a living fish. The wounded man then collapsed to the ground with a hand over his face.
"I believe I may need medical assistance."
Stacy turned, blinding me with the headlamp she wore.
"There's a first aid kit in my Rover behind the passenger seat. Grab it for me."
As I took off down the trail, I remembered a similar incident years ago in which it had been Stacy who had been injured by an attacking animal. In that case, it had been a feral boar in the foothills of southwestern Maine. It took me 5 minutes to return with supplies. I found Stacy clutching a handkerchief to her friend's face. He might have been wearing a red mask.
"Never had that happen before."
His voice betrayed the genuine fear he was feeling.
"Are you sure my nose is still attached?
Let's have a look."
I was struck by her calmness. Stacy had never been one to keep her cool. In the focused light of her headlamp, I could see that Buster's nose was ragged but intact. The python's teeth had missed the major veins and arteries in his neck, fortunately, but his sun-reddened face was mangled and would require surgery to repair.
"How maimed am I?"
he asked.
"Mildly," said Stacy, squeezing his hand. "You're mildly maimed."
Buster blinked at me through blood-crusted lashes.
"What did you spray into her mouth, anyway?"
"Deet."
"No wonder she sounds like she swallowed a gallon of bleach."
The snake thumped in its cloth prison. The sound made my heart hurt. The loud bird, a barn owl I now believed it to be, screamed again from the darkness of the cypresses. Chapter 5. Mist rose from the crushed clamshells and drifted through my headlights as I turned into the lot outside the ranger station. I climbed out of the Land Rover and stood there in the unbroken heat listening to the night noises. The frogs were making deep, resonant grunts like an orchestra consisting entirely of tiny bassoons. A minute later, the top-heavy Ford Expedition swung in beside the Rover. Stacy opened the driver's door. Beside her sat Buster. His huge, bristling face was bandaged from his lips to his hairline. The gauze was spotted with blood, but he was smoking a cigarette.
"Do you want me to follow you to the hospital?" I asked as she stepped out of the vehicle.
"There's no need for the two of us to wait around there."
She waggled a key loose from her key ring.
"Why don't you go clean up at my house? I don't know how long I'll be, but maybe you can catch a few winks and I'll be home in time to take you to breakfast."
The idea of showering at my ex-girlfriend's felt like a betrayal of Danny. Stacy noticed my hesitancy.
"I won't even be there, Mike. I'm sure Danielle will understand."
At first, her use of Danny's full name seemed like a jab, but there was no mockery in her tone. Buster called from the expedition.
"I'm still bleeding here."
"His injuries look worse than they are," she said in a whisper.
"When did you get certified as an EMT?" I asked.
"Stevens!"
"Buster's really a sweetheart if you get to know him."
"So's my wolf dog, but I'm careful not to get too close when he shows his teeth." She wrapped her arms around my neck and kissed me goodbye. The kiss was light, but on the lips. 45 minutes later, my GPS announced that I had arrived in Everglades City. Stacy's rented house stood on elevated pilings to protect it from storm surges. It had a low pyramidal roof, designed to minimize the impact of hurricane-force winds. At first glance, the interior also looked like Florida distilled to its essence. Rattan furniture, tile flooring, potted palms, but mementos of Maine peeked out from the shelves. I recognized a box turtle shell I had found on patrol, and there was the edition of Audubon's Birds of America. We had bought it from an antiquarian bookseller on a rainy afternoon down east. On the walls hung Stacy's framed photographs of Maine animals, a moose and her calf, a lynx on a snowy road, an osprey perched with a fish atop a snag. These same pictures had decorated the house we'd shared for close to 2 years. She wasn't a great photographer, but she knew how to creep up on wild animals before they spotted her. Her finest photograph, though, was a black-and-white portrait she had taken of her father. Charlie Stevens looked sideways at the camera, his big chin raised, laugh wrinkles cutting lines in his weathered skin. His thick white hair stood up as if seconds before he had run one of his strong hands through it. His expression was one of faux suspicion. No wonder she missed him. I did too in that moment. I showered as fast as I could, marveling at the dozens of mosquito bites I had sustained in such a short time. Afterward, I stood before the mirror while the steam lifted from the edges of the glass. I hadn't expected these feelings. I needed to leave. Stacy had texted me from the hospital with an update. Buster was receiving stitches on his nose and jaw for the snake bite. The copious blood had made the wounds appear worse than they were, as she had deduced. I texted back that I was glad for the good news. I thanked her for the use of her shower. I didn't tell her that I would be gone before she returned home. After I'd dressed, I sat down at her kitchen table with a pen and notepad, trying to find the right words to justify my graceless departure. Again, I thanked Stacy for her hospitality, but said that I needed to head back to Miami, lest unforeseen circumstances cause me to miss yet another plane. It wasn't the whole truth, nor was it a lie. After a long, silent debate with myself, I signed the note with love. I had just put down the pen when my phone rang. Stacy's mother, Aura, smiled up at me from the lighted screen. She had snow-white hair, pale green eyes, and was, honestly, the most beautiful older woman I had ever seen. The coincidence of Aura calling here and now made me shiver. Then I realized it was after midnight, well past her usual bedtime, and I became even more worried. Aura? Mike? Where are you? Still in Florida. I have a morning flight back to Maine. Has something happened to Charlie? It was the only reason I could imagine for her calling me that late. You haven't heard from him? No, why? He's gone off without a word of explanation. What do you mean? He's disappeared. I have no idea where or why. Mike, I don't think he wants me to know where he went. Chapter 6. 5 hours later, I boarded an Airbus A321 bound for Portland, Maine. I had sped east across the Everglades and arrived at the Miami airport as the rising sun was prying open a crack between the gray sky and the gray ocean. I took my seat beside the window and gazed out at the acres of interlocking tarmac strips. Boat-tailed grackles glided down to peck for insects in the grass islands between the taxiways. I texted Danny to tell her I'd made my flight. I had one hell of a story to share upon my return to Maine. It involves a Burmese python, I wrote. And Stacy. After we'd taken off, I removed my briefcase from under the seat and retrieved the notes I had taken of my conversation with Aura Stevens. When you become a law enforcement officer, your academy instructors stress the importance of making careful records of important conversations, but it's a lesson you only learn for real when a defense attorney gets one of your arrests thrown out because you were sloppy with your note-taking. I spread the pages across the tray table. When was the last time you saw him? I'd asked Aura. Yesterday morning, he woke me as he was getting dressed in the dark, but I fell back asleep. How many hours ago specifically was that? She paused to count. 41? To civilians, this might have seemed a long time to wait before reporting her septuagenarian husband missing. But Charlie had been a game warden for decades, and long absences from home had been a part of their life together. Fatal collisions between moose and cars, search and rescue missions, and hunts for armed fugitives happened at all hours. But he was retired now, and had been for a while. And even in his active duty days, he wouldn't have left home without giving his wife a full explanation. Did he say anything about when he'd be back? Not a word. I assume you've tried calling his phone? He doesn't pick up, Mike. I keep getting his voicemail box. I had never known Charlie to forget his mobile phone or travel anywhere without it. Granted, cell coverage in Maine is worse than spotty. It is effectively non-existent except around the larger population centers, but in extremis, we might use the GPS tracker in his phone to triangulate on his location. He didn't leave a note? Just a short one beside my coffee. Charlie makes me a cup every morning the way I like. I love you, Aura. I'll be back as soon as I get a puzzle sorted out. He only uses my name when he's deadly serious. Usually, as you know, he calls me Boss. The nickname was a term of affection no younger man could get away with calling his partner in this day and age. Did you hear his plane leave the dock? That's another thing. He didn't take the Skyhawk. He took his old Ford. Wait, he didn't fly? No. The old pilot was famous for never driving anywhere he could fly, even if it was just down to Callis to pick up a chainsaw blade from the hardware store. He'd park his Cessna float plane in the St. Croix River while he ran errands. If Charlie had taken his truck, a sap green Ranger, he'd done so for one reason, because his ultimate destination was inaccessible by air. Aura, this next question is difficult, but have you noticed anything unusual about Charlie's state of mind? He's not showing signs of dementia. I only ask because he's getting older, we both are. But the answer to your question is no. Have you reached out to anyone else? You're the closest thing he has to a son, Mike. If he didn't tell you, I don't know who he would have. Nick Francis, maybe? Nick was the retired chief of the Passamaquoddy Nation. Before that, he'd been the tribal police chief. And before that, he'd been a game warden who'd worked alongside Charlie when they were both young officers in an era when Native Americans in Down East Maine faced harassment and violence unthinkable to modern Americans. Can you call Nick and ask if he's heard from Charlie lately? Yes, but I will have to tell him the truth given the things they've been through together. Hopefully he'll have some useful information. Let me backtrack a little. Did anything unusual happen the day before Charlie left home? We took the van down to Machias to catch some of the sea breeze and have pie at Helen's. We ran into lots of people we know at the dike. You know how social Charlie is, how he always makes the rounds among the booths. And then we drove home. Come to think of it, he was awfully quiet on the drive back. The dike was the local name for the wide Route 1 causeway that ran parallel to the Machias River and served as an embankment dam, keeping the little river from undercutting the road. On pleasant days, antiques dealers and craftspeople set out tables along the side of the road, turning the causeway into a pop-up bazaar. Who did he talk to there? I didn't see. My chapter of Planned Parenthood was gathering signatures, and I covered a shift at the booth while Charlie made his rounds. But his change in mood happened after you left the dike and were headed back to the lake? I think that would be accurate. So he either spoke with someone in Machias or saw something there that rattled him, and that event was likely the cause of his decision to drive off without telling his wife where he was going. Did you see him talking with anyone in particular, someone who might have set him off? When we parked, he pointed out a table neither of us remembered seeing before. It looked like the dealer had some taxidermy and rusted old junk from the logging camps. You know how interested Charlie is in Northwood's history. And he didn't mention this dealer to you later? Maybe he made an offhand comment that struck you as strange? No, but... Go ahead.
I had the oddest sense he might have bought something from the man. He kept putting his hand in the pocket of his jacket.
Could it have been a gift for you?
That was what I'd suspected, but he was awfully quiet and serious when we got home. After supper, he asked my permission to go out to the boathouse to tinker on his plane. I was asleep when he finally came to bed, and then, as I said, he woke me at 4 o'clock, putting on his clothes in the dark. That's early, even for that bantam rooster.
By now, I was deeply worried about my old friend. I was also conscious that I couldn't disclose my fears to Aura when I was so far from home and in no position to take action.
My flight to Portland leaves in 5 hours, I had said. If you hear anything from Charlie or he comes home before I take off, call me. I'm pretty sure the plane doesn't have Wi-Fi, but you can send me emails to read during my layover or when I return to Maine. In the meantime, I need you to make some calls and see if you can find the name of the junk dealer Charlie spoke with at the dike. I'll need to stop at my house on the way north, but with luck, I can be at your place by mid-afternoon.
I'll call around town.
And Mike? She'd said.
Please don't tell Stacy about her father being missing.
Chapter 7. When I landed in Maine, the flight attendant gave us the local time and temperature over the intercom. Somehow, it was hotter in Portland than it had been in Miami. While we taxied, I turned my phone back on to receive cell signals and to submit the report I'd written on Wheelwright. Danny had called to say she couldn't wait to hear about my encounter with the python. She asked if Stacy had seemed happy. She added that she was going to be spending the day at the firearms qualification course at the Maine Criminal Justice Academy with the rest of her troop. Danny had always been a crack shot. Stacy had sent me a text.
You bum. I was looking forward to catching up over breakfast. I was hoping to hear about you and Danny. She seems good for you.
You seem good. Aura had left me an email. While I had been en route, she'd been busy querying the other vendors who sold their wares along the dike and had learned that the stranger hadn't given his name. The city of Machias didn't require sellers to obtain permits to set up their tables. I called her now from the terminal. She sounded brighter now that the sun was up.
Carol Boyce, who sells her paintings right next to where this man set up shop, overheard Charlie arguing with him over some trinket he had for sale.
I remembered Carol. A big, flowing woman.
Did Mrs. Boyce say what it was?
She couldn't hear, unfortunately, but she said the argument got heated.
I guess I'll be stopping in Machias before I head to your place.
Did you happen to speak with Nick Francis?
He said he didn't know where Charlie might be, but he didn't seem worried. He said I should be patient before I put out a silver alert on the best woodsman in Maine.
That's an odd thing to say.
You have to know Nick's sense of humor, Aura said. But I feel better knowing that you're back in Maine. If anyone can track down that man of mine, it's you, Mike.
I appreciated her confidence, but I felt the task I'd taken on was weightier than I'd at first realized. Charlie's disappearance wasn't just another investigation. It was far more important than that, potentially a matter of life and death. I was waiting for my luggage and baggage claim when I noticed a tall, sandy-haired woman at the next carousel. She had her back to me, but I recognized her broad shoulders and the service dog sitting with preternatural stillness at her side, a tawny Belgian Malinois. The breed is a high-energy cousin to the German Shepherd, and this one was wearing a red search dog in training vest. I happen to know this animal was well past the training stage, but the vest probably helped keep off handsy strangers.
Kathy!
My former sergeant, Kathy Frost, turned to me, as did Maple, her canine partner.
Grasshopper! What's shaking?
My world, as usual.
I'm the last person you need to tell that to.
Kathy had one of those expressive faces that is attractive because you can see the goodness of her character in it. She had been my field training officer, assigned to hold my hand during my rookie year, and then she had become one of my closest friends.
the first woman in the history of the Maine Warden Service and its first female sergeant. She'd had her promising career cut short when she'd been ambushed outside her house by an enemy she'd never known she had. The attempted murderer fired a burst of shotgun pellets into her abdomen, and it still struck me as proof of God's existence that she had survived. The Malinois recognized me as a friend and fellow packmate, whipped her black-tipped tail back and forth. I fell down upon one knee to receive her dog kisses.
"Hey, Maple, how you doing, girl? Have you been digging up bodies?"
"Not this time," said Kathy. "We were at Quantico teaching a program for first responders from around the country." That explained her dappled complexion. Kathy's freckles tended to multiply the tanner she got. Before her forced retirement, she had headed up the Warden Service's canine team. She now worked as a consultant for law enforcement agencies around the country and even abroad, teaching officers how to train dogs to recover corpses.
"What about you?" she asked. "Where are you coming from in your fancy linen suit?"
"Doing a background check in Florida."
"Florida? Really?"
The intensity of her curiosity was such that Maple heard the excitement in her voice and pricked up her ears.
"Anywhere near where a certain wildlife biologist is living?"
Kathy had been present for the beginning, middle, and end of my relationship with Stacy, including the latter's decampment for a new life in the Everglades. They had been friendly, if not friends. Danny, on the other hand, was one of Kathy's beloved trainees. I spotted my bag coming around the S-shaped conveyor belt. Considering it contained my locked sidearm, I made a dash for it, glad for the interruption. When I returned, Kathy said,
"I don't suppose you have time to grab lunch?"
"I wish I could, but I've left Shadow alone too long."
"Danny, too."
"Come on, Kathy.
All I'm saying is you've got a good thing going for once in your life."
"I'm not unaware."
"Hey, there's my bag. We should get together soon, the three of us."
"Absolutely." We said our goodbyes, and I began the long march to the parking lot. Almost at once, I regretted not having clued Kathy in on the mystery around Charlie's disappearance. The two former wardens had worked together for years, and maybe she had an insight. But I hadn't wanted to betray Aura's confidence until I had a better sense of the situation. I threw my bags in the back of my personal vehicle, a restored 1980 International Harvester Scout. It was only the last week of June, but the air had the heaviness of hurricane season. I had traveled 2,000 miles and still hadn't escaped the hot, wet grip of the Everglades. I'd been away for just a week, and yet somehow I'd missed the end of spring and the beginning of summer. The lupins along Route 1 had faded. By contrast, the birches, maples, and beeches were fully leafed out. If anything, Maine looked even more verdant than Florida. It was greener in more ways than one. The state had recently legalized the recreational use of marijuana. Every few miles, a new dispensary had arisen along the coastal road. Ye Old Toke Shop, Mary Jane's, Medicinal Mart, Cannabis Rex, Herbal Nirvana. Like the gold rush of the 19th century, I suspected the dope rush of the 21st would end in tears and bankruptcies. The real winners would be the same transnational corporations who peddled tobacco and needed a new drug to sell. I hadn't warned Logan Kronk that I was coming. The sight that greeted me as I pulled into my pine-shaded dooryard nearly made my eyes pop from my skull. Shadow's fenced pen was littered with small bones, piles of feathers, and tatters of fur. A trio of crows perched in the high branches of the poplars within the acre-plus enclosure, waiting for a chance to pick at the gnawed carcasses without being devoured themselves. The recumbent wolf opened one golden eye when he heard me drive up. He recognized the telltale sound of my engine, but waited for me to approach the fence to rouse himself. He gave a shake that raised a cloud of hair, dander, and pollen, then trotted down to the gate to greet me.
"What have you been eating?"
he yawned,
revealing 2-inch-long teeth.
Seriously, dude, what is all this crap?
He sniffed the wire as a signal he wanted me to offer my hand. When I did, he licked my fingertips. Maybe it was a gesture of affection, but more likely he wanted to taste the residual grease from the pizza slice I'd grabbed at a convenience store. I heard a bicycle behind me and, turning, saw Logan Kronk pedaling hard down my long drive. His blue eyes were bright with excitement. His blonde hair was so long and feathery he looked like a pop star from the last days of disco. One half of his face was crimson with a rash, as vivid as a port wine birthmark.
"Uncle Mike, how come you didn't tell me you were home?"
"Logan, what happened to your face?"
"It's them caterpillars," he said, scratching. "The ones with the poison hairs."
He was talking about the larvae of brown-tailed moths, I realized. On the drive home, I had spotted some of their webs in the branches of oak trees.
The caterpillars had bristles or setae that they shed, which caused allergic reactions not unlike those caused by poison ivy.
In recent years, the moth infestations had spread northeast along the coast. It was hard for me not to see the warmth-loving pests as harbingers of a worse future.
"What's with all the bones?
You told me Shadow killed a turkey that landed inside his pen, but from the looks of things, a whole flock got in there. Plus, God knows what else." The boy's grin showed a crooked set of teeth. His parents lacked the money to have them straightened.
"It's roadkill."
"What?"
"I was reading that wolves are super hungry all the time and prefer fresh meat and stuff, and I've been riding around with a trash bag picking up the dead animals along the side of the road."
"You'd better not have gone inside the fence, Logan."
"Heck no! I would never have broken the rules."
He scratched an inflamed ear.
"Even though I think Shadow kinda likes me."
I had only recently dared enter the animal's compound myself, and that was with a can of pepper spray that I doubted would have kept the black beast from ripping out my throat.
"That's a dangerous way of thinking," I said. "You look into his eyes and it feels like you know what's going on inside his head, but that's just a way we fool ourselves, Logan. Even with regular dogs, we need to remember that their minds work differently from ours. People are really good at convincing themselves that the things they want to believe are true."
"Yeah, but he really likes you." The kid hadn't heard a word I'd said. He was only 10. What had I expected? "Thank you for giving him that roadkill. It added some variety to his diet. He looks big and healthy again." The wolf had come into my care after having been shot by a crossbow bolt that had collapsed one of his lungs and permanently damaged ligaments that he needed to chase down prey. His convalescence had lasted many months.
"Do you think he'll ever live in the house with you?"
"It's tough to make predictions, Logan, especially about the future." The wit and wisdom of Yogi Berra was lost on the 10-year-old. "Listen," I said, "I have to take a trip north. I'm not sure for how long. Would you consider watching him a few more days? Of course, I'll pay you for the work you've already done."
"Really?"
I opened my wallet and pulled out a $20 bill for every day I had been away, $140 in all. His father had said Logan was saving for his first .22 rifle, and this windfall would be more than enough to finance the purchase. The joy in his inflamed face produced an unexpected emotion in me. I became keenly aware of not having a family of my own, nor even the prospect of one. Danny had made it clear that she had no interest in becoming a mother. After Logan had ridden off, I looked into the eyes of the wolf and said,
"I missed you, pal."
And despite everything I just told the boy about the unknowability of animal minds, I could have sworn Shadow understood me.